you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Orb Kelly, and joining me this week is another pal from our network, Ryan Daly. Ryan, welcome to Treasury Cast.
Well, you know, it's great to be here on the greatest podcast format of all time.
I love it. Yeah, this one was very easy to schedule because I just walked down the hall at Fire and Water Central, and Ryan was in the middle of working on another episode of It's Midnight, and I just said, hey, can you do Treasury Cast? And it worked out.
I was in the bullpen.
That's right. We had the water coolers, the whole thing. Yeah, it's great. You should see the offices. They're quite swanky. Those in-stock trades ads really pay for quite a bit, I got to say. Anyway, Ryan is here to talk about a very, very special Treasury. I mean, I know they're all special in their own way, but this one, for me, is especially special. This is Marvel Treasury Edition number 18, The Astonishing Spider-Man, which is a series of Spider-Man team-ups. So, Ryan, why did you want to talk about this one?
In a way, this is the Treasury Edition that I never knew I always wanted. Okay. And what I mean by that is I finally got this book about a year ago. I am a neophyte when it comes to the Treasury Editions. I grew up just too late. I kind of missed that era. And I also, if I saw them in the store, I was probably one of those people who was just like, well, where am I going to put that if I get it? It's going to throw off my stacks, my long boxes. So it's only been a couple of years that I've had any Treasury Editions, but I got this one about a year ago at the same time that I got the two special editions for Star Wars that collected the first miniseries. But I had seen the cover to this one and I don't even remember where I first saw it, but I do remember distinctly seeing this cover and just being blown away by the image. And we can talk about that in more depth, and just thinking that is like one of the coolest like images for just a random Marvel comic I've ever seen. And I would so love to read that comic and find out what story that is. Not necessarily knowing that it was an anthology, but just thinking like what brought all of these people together: Spider-Man, the Werewolf by Night, Ghost Rider, the original X-Men in their civilian clothes, and Iron Fist. You know. Yeah. It just looks so cool. So when I actually saw it in a stack of Treasury Editions in the store about a year ago, I was like, this is it. This is the one. And you were talking about like the Treasury Cast, if you hadn't started it by then, I don't think, but you were talking about it. I was like, this is what I can talk to Rob about.
There we go. Yeah. Well, let's talk about it. This is a great, great image. It's by Bob Budiansky and Ernie Chan. It's got Spider-Man on the wall with a spotlight, and it's got the other characters all posing. And yeah, the X-Men in their civilian garb, which we'll get to more in the X-Men momentarily. I love the X-Men in their civilian garb. I don't know why, but I do. I think they look so cool.
I do too, and it kind of goes to my thing. Like, I think it's sort of a personal preference to me, but I don't think of the X-Men as a super team necessarily. And I don't think the best stories for them necessarily have that kind of feel. I see them as more of kind of outcasts and societal rejects that wouldn't necessarily have the same feeling as the Avengers or something like that. So
yeah. Oh, sure.
I'm cool with them just dressing like normal people. But
yeah, they look real. I love Cyclops in his suit and his his glasses, and Angel is bare-chested. Everybody looks really cool. And, of course, this cover is a parody of the Band on the Run album cover by Paul McCartney and Wings. It took me many years to really learn that. This book came out on August 1st, 1978, and that is a very, very special date for me. For those of you who have listened to Fire and Water, and I assume that's a good chunk of you, you've heard me go on and on and on when I talk about Mountain Comics. And, of course, those are comics that I bought while I was on vacation with my family in the Poconos. It is probably, you know, it's certainly the best parts of my childhood were those weeks we spent in the Poconos. And I remember buying this comic off the stands. I remember the store that I bought it in. There was a marina up there called White Beauty, and this was in the days when stores, or not stores, but like places like marinas would be an all-purpose, like they would have a newsstand and a gift shop. Nowadays, nowadays they don't have that anymore. You know, like basically Target and Walmart serves those needs, and everybody else just specializes. But White Beauty had a gift shop which had a newsstand. And they had these giant racks, and they had this treasury. And my parents bought me this treasury probably because it just looks so bloody cool. And I love this book so much that I pretty much spent the entire vacation reading it. And this is something that you'll see in the gallery post that's going to be on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. There is a picture of the seven-year-old me with my cousin reading this treasury. And if you look at the photo, you'll see parked on the couch next to me are my Star Wars figures as we're looking at the puzzle pages. And then I myself was so excited at this comic at 7 years old that I took a picture of the book by itself. I simply propped the book up in a chair and took a photo. And you're going to see those photos on the gallery page. They have survived all these years. This book is like – this is what I think about when I think of buying Mountain Comics is this book. It's just so, so beloved to me. So I'm so glad, Ryan, that you wanted to talk about it because this was like at the top of the list. I'm like, I want to get to this. This is so much fun. And it's funny that, you know, they said this cover is a parody of the Band on the Run cover from Paul McCartney and Wings, because in a lot of ways, Paul McCartney and Wings is the soundtrack to my trips up there, because we didn't have a TV. It was a cabin, and we didn't it didn't come with a TV. So we had radio and stuff to read. And Paul McCartney and Wings were cranking out one hit after the next in the 70s. And so, you know, this is like everything about the Pocono trips to me combined into one thing. It's a Paul, Paul McCartney parody cover on a Spider-Man comic. It's just beautiful. And plus, it's just a great drawing by Buddy Yensky and Chan. It's very, very dramatic.
Yeah, it totally is. I wish mine was less blemished than it is. As I was telling you before our episode really started, I got this for pretty cheap. And the reason is because the condition is like beyond dog-eared, but I think it lends a certain amount of charm to it, like how like white and faded and wrinkly the sides are. There is more than one piece of transparent Scotch tape holding holding the cover together, covering up part of Jean Grey. But it's still, gosh, it's so cool. And I think even the condition of this lends it more history. And I think maybe that does actually make the image better. Just the feel of it, the weight, the years in this one.
It's well loved. It was a well loved book over the years. So that's tremendous.
Oh, I'll tell you later on how well loved this was when we get to one of the like fun interactive pages.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. We love kids with their markers. So anyway, yeah, that's the cover. And on the inside cover is a great table of contents explaining the stories. It's at The Amazing Spider-Man. It shows these little panels all in black and white of the Spider-Man with the X-Men, Spider-Man with Werewolf by Night, Spider-Man with Ghost Rider, and Spider-Man with Iron Fist, and then some puzzle fun and crazy ad pages from Not Brand Eck. So we'll get to all that. We'll get to all that stuff momentarily. So the first story is Spider-Man and the X-Men together. The story is called "And Then the X-Men" by Jerry Conway, Gil Kane, Steve Mitchell, John Costanza, and Roy Thomas. It's from Marvel Team Up number 4. Spider-Man is blamed for the kidnapping of a renowned scientist, when it is really the work of Morbius, the living vampire. There's a newspaper headline, of course, blaming Spider-Man for the kidnapping, of course, at the Daily Bugle. It's noticed by Professor Charles Xavier, who was friends with the man. He calls his X-Men to duty, and he tells them to investigate. The X-Men, save for Beast, find a sickly Spider-Man, and they fight him to a standstill, ending with Spidey passing out. They bring him back to the school, where Xavier probes his mind and learns about the Wallcrawler's previous battle with Morbius. Realizing his mistake, thinking the Spider-Man was their enemy, he commands the X-Men to find Morbius, who is holed up in an apartment with his prey. He warns the man, he wants the man to return to his work so he can find a cure for Morbius' affliction. The X-Men find Morbius on the streets of New York, about to claim another victim. They subdue him, thanks to a bank shot of Cyclops' eye beams, and bring him back to the school as well. Spider-Man wakes up and is shocked to see Morbius there too. He is told by the scientist that the only reason he survived is because Jean Grey found him, and there was enough time for him to come up with a cure for Morbius' blood that was flowing in Spidey's system as a result of a previous encounter. As a way of thanks, Spidey lifts his mask and plants a big wet kiss on Jean Grey and then takes off, leaving Morbius in the hands of a pensive Professor X. Ryan, what do you think of this story?
It reminds me why I loved Gil Kane.
Oh, the artwork in there is unbelievably good.
Yeah, it is. And in particular, I love the way he draws the X-Men in this story. I mean, his depiction of Spider-Man when Spider-Man is swinging through the skyline in some of these pages is really, really good. But damn, I love his X-Men in this. Like the on page 7, the one shot in the middle of Cyclops in his costume. I just think there's
the
like
upshot, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's like a length and an angularness to Cyclops that I really like. And that's a kind of a classic thing that Gil Kane would frequently do. But once he shows them in their civilian garb again, like in like the next page, I love, again, like seeing Scott in his suit, but with those glasses. And they're not red tinged in this copy, like just straight black. They look good. Jean looks great. Ah, gosh, yeah, the art, it really blows me away. The story is all over the place because it's cramming a couple of different things in there, but it's still so much fun.
Yeah, it's picking up threads from a previous team-up. I mean, I guess it was in a previous issue of Marvel Team-Up that had Spider-Man and the Human Torch fighting Morbius where he got bit, so it's following that. And if you didn't know that, it's kind of like, well, when did that happen? But okay, there is a flashback to it. But yeah, the artwork is really beautiful. Steve Mitchell is a great anchor for Gil Kane. Apparently, they didn't do a lot of work together. I remember reading an interview with Steve Mitchell in Back Issue, I think it was, or maybe it might have been Comic Book Artist, which was sort of the earlier version of that magazine, where he talked about inking this very issue, and he fell behind, and he kept getting phone calls, and they're like, Steve, you done? You done yet, Steve? And he's like, I'm trying to get as done as fast as I can. And according to him, it kind of – and not ruined his career. That's a little dramatic because he went on to have a long career in inking. But he never really got assigned a Major League Spider-Man title after this because he fell behind. But, boy, he did a really great job. I mean, I think him – and he gives Kane's stuff like this little extra level of grit to it, which I really like. I like that that's Gil Kane himself making an appearance on page 6 where they're looking at the Daily Bugle.
Oh yeah.
You see the headline, it says Spider-Man kidnaps noted scientist, and then there's a tiny second story and it says well-known cartoonist found in, and then it's cut off, and there's a little drawing of a drawing, and that's a drawing of Gil Kane.
Nice.
So I think it's
nice.
Gil drawing himself. And yeah, you know, growing up, I never knew the X-Men did any plainclothes adventures. Like, I was so baffled. I was like, they look like spies. I thought they looked – and Jean Grey looks great in her, like, hip huggers and her straight red hair. She's a classic hippie chick. They just look badass. I really love it.
I know. And this makes me wish that, A, we got more, like, you know, classic X-Men by Gil Kane, but also written by Jerry Conway. Because, I grew up loving the X-Men. I've sort of fallen out of love with them as I've gotten older. I just think it was something that I needed for my youth. But I've read a crap load of X-Men comics. And I just think I don't really care for the original ones. Like certainly like the Stan and Jack era. And then even when Roy Thomas came aboard, I don't think it really picked up until later in that run before it was sort of canceled or just became a reprint book.
Right.
So the classic X-Men stories with this cast – don't really do it for me. But reading a story like this, I was like, man, if we could have gotten more by this team or something like it, this type of story, I think I would have had a lot more fun with these characters.
Yeah, I dig these four plainclothes X-Men running around in the streets of New York just doing Professor X's bidding. And I think the reason that Beast isn't in the story, he has a one-panel appearance. This was right around the time that he underwent that transformation from the sort of ape-like looking creature to the blue furry version. And I think that's what they're referring to. Because he had a solo strip in, I think, in Amazing Adventures? Was that what it was?
Yeah.
Amazing Thrills? Supernatural? One of those titles. Somebody's
yelling. I think it was Amazing Adventures.
I think you're right. And but that's why he's not in this story.
Yeah, I looked it up a while ago. And I think he had just done it 4 issues before this.
Okay.
But I think it was a bi-monthly title, so it would have been like maybe 7 or 8 months. Around this time, like so that had relatively similar to like when this was taking place, that had just kind of happened. So yeah, that's why he's not in the story.
Right. And then I also, one other detail I love to mention, I love that the X-Men ride around in a convertible. I'm like, this is just like, make this X-Men's Netflix series. Just 70s X-Men adventures of them running around in a convertible. And I love that Spidey gives Jean Grey a smooch. I think now in probably slightly more enlightened times, we would probably be like a little like, hey, Spidey, she didn't ask for that. But
right.
But at the same time, you know, it's Spider-Man's being, you know, cheeky. And I love when he leaves, he goes through a window. As opposed to, he could have lifted the window. No, he actually smashes through it, just breaks it. And in the final panel, we even see Jean Grey. Look, she has a slight smile on her face, so obviously she didn't mind the little peck from Spider-Man.
Well, I'm thinking that he kissed Jean, and his spider sense told him, hey, the other guys aren't so happy about that. The guy with the glasses, he's not happy. And Spider's
he
like,
I don't have face.
I don't have time to open this window. So, but you mentioned like the convertible and the 70s-ness, and I'm going to say this a lot as we go through, because as a kind of time capsule, this particular treasury is very much Spider-Man interacting with the world of Marvel in the 70s. And they're different types, and you know, Marvel has their different ages, and I love the 60s, the classic sort of Marvel age with Stan and Jack and Stan and Steve Ditko and all of the greatness that came out of Fantastic Four and Spider-Man and the different Avengers characters. But I also have so much love for the 70s, which became sort of dominated by these genre characters, Werewolf by Night, Tomb of Dracula, the horror books, then the sort of exploitation stories like Luke Cage or Power Man, Iron Fist, and then the sort of licensed things like Star Wars and Conan and other stuff like that. And this is sort of like just Spider-Man interacting with all those great 70s concepts.
Yeah, this is really a terrific story, and I'm glad that this is one of the ones they picked, because it's just – this otherwise would have just been in an old issue of Marvel Team-Up, but I probably never would have seen it, you know?
No.
I just would have been – and, yeah, over time, much like you with the X-Men – we all go through an X-Men phase, to quote Jag. I got to a point with the X-Men where I was like, yeah, I'm enough of this, you know? But if the X-Men had been this, I think I might have been, like, super, super excited. I really dig this.
Oh. These guys, like – and I know – The X-Men are often compared to the Doom Patrol, even though I think the Doom Patrol owe a lot more to the Fantastic Four than they do the X-Men. But this quartet, and with Xavier as the fifth one, this feels like a kind of hip, attractive version of the Doom Patrol.
Ooh, Paul Hicks is shaking his fist now. He's just mad.
He knows. They're supposed to be freaks.
He's shaking his fist 10 hours ahead of us. We're fine. So, okay, well, the next story, why don't you, Ryan, take it away.
Sure, I will take this one. And I really love Werewolf by Night, so I couldn't help myself. So I really threw a lot into this synopsis. So bear with us. Grab a drink and hold on to something. Wolf at Bay is reprinted from Marvel Team-Up Issue 12, originally printed in 1973. The story is plotted by Jerry Conway, scripted by Len Wein, penciled by Ross Andrew, inked by Don Perlin, lettered by Charlotte Jeter, colored by Glynis Wein, and edited by Roy Thomas. The story opens with Spider-Man running across the support cable of a bridge, but this isn't one of the many famous bridges of his native New York. This is the Golden Gate Bridge of San Francisco, California. The wall crawler has come out west, hoping to distract himself with new sights, sounds, and smells. Anything to take his mind off the recent deaths of his girlfriend Gwen Stacy and his archenemy, the Green Goblin. The distraction works well enough that Spider-Man doesn't notice the fur-covered werewolf stalking him on the bridge until the monster leaps out at him. Spider-Man's spidey sense warns him too late, and the werewolf collides with the wall crawler, sending both of them tumbling off the cable and down to the bridge below. As Spider-Man falls, he has time to flash back to how he got here. He was back at the office of the Daily Bugle in his civilian identity as Peter Parker, asking his boss, J. Jonah Jameson, for a photo assignment that would take him out of town. Jameson understood Peter's need to get out of New York to help him process Gwen Stacy's death, but he wasn't going to pay for a freelancer's mental health care. Hey, he's J. Jonah Jameson, for crying out loud. Luckily, Jameson's better angel, Robbie Robinson, came in with an assignment that would send Peter to San Francisco to capture photos of Daredevil and Black Widow for the Bugle's Sunday magazine section. So that explains why Spider-Man is in San Fran, but it doesn't help his current situation of falling off the Golden Gate Bridge. A quick shot from his web shooters creates a handy web trampoline that Spidey and the werewolf bounce off of and land safely on the concrete bridge. A speeding car nearly crashes into them, but the driver sees the werewolf at the last minute and swerves out of the way. The werewolf attacks Spider-Man again, but the web-slinger lands a solid kick at the monster's face. Dazed, the werewolf leaps at him again, but Spider-Man ducks, and the werewolf's momentum takes him over the side of the bridge. Spider-Man scans the rippling water, waiting for any sign that the creature survived the fall. He fails to notice a swirl of smoke behind him, smoke that for one brief moment takes on the likeness of a face before fading away. Thinking the werewolf dead, Spider-Man finishes his swing across the bridge, the whole intent of which was to save money traveling from the airport. Now that he's in town, though, he ducks into an alley and changes back into his civvies and enters a diner as Peter Parker. The waitress who takes his order seems to be moving on autopilot, and Peter notices all of the people in the diner act the same way. Just then, though, the werewolf enters the diner, having tracked Peter from the bridge. Peter and the wolf, fight in the diner, and as Peter's clothing gets shredded, he happens to notice that none of the patrons or the waitstaff in the diner react to the fight. Peter leads the werewolf outside and defeats him with the same trick that he used on the bridge, waiting for the monster to pounce and leaping out of the way. This time, the werewolf slams headfirst into the side of a parked car and collapses, unconscious. Peter strips off his ruined civilian clothes and changes back to Spider-Man, grateful for the moment that none of the people would recognize him. Not that any of them seem capable of recognizing anything, as the diner patrons and others nearby come out and begin walking down the street as if they're all in a trance. Spidey considers following them, but then he notices that the werewolf is moving. Sort of. It begins to change shape, and as Spider-Man stares in disbelief, the monster reverts back to his normal human form of Jack Russell. Yes, Jack Russell. Jack tells Spider-Man that he came to San Francisco with his sister Lissa and his best friend Buck. They felt compelled to check out the show of a stage magician named Moondark. Though Jack was thoroughly bored by the magic act, Buck and Lissa were entranced, just like the people of the diner. Then Moondark stared at Jack and put a whammy on him. He cast a spell on Jack that transformed him into the werewolf despite the lack of a full moon. The evil magician sent the werewolf to kill Spider-Man, believing that the wall crawler had come to San Francisco to stop his plans for world domination or, you know, whatever. Moondark commanded a cloud of smoke called the Mists of Passage that served as a portal, teleporting the werewolf to the Golden Gate Bridge, where he initially fought Spider-Man. With this exposition out of the way, Spider-Man swings to Moondark's theater, with Jack in tow. They break into the building, but as soon as they enter, Jack transforms back into the werewolf that is under Moondark's control. He attacks Spider-Man, and the two of them fight through the building until they finally arrive in Moondark's lair, where he holds Lissa and Buck in a trance. Figuring that Moondark's presence is what controls the werewolf, Spider-Man finally disengages from his fight with the monster to kick Moondark, knocking himself and the magician back into the Mists of Passage. With Moondark gone, his evil hold over the werewolf is ended, and the monster changes back to Jack Russell, the human. The spell over Jack's friends is also broken, and he explains to Lissa and Buck what happened. Meanwhile, Spider-Man and Moondark teleported back to the Golden Gate Bridge. Spidey, with his superior powers, manages to grab hold of the cable at the last second, but Moondark fell all of the way down to the water. Figuring no mere human could survive the fall, Spider-Man swings off to complete his photo assignment for the Daily Bugle. As he swings away, he fails to notice the bubbles rising from the water beneath the bridge. And that is the story.
Woo! That was a complete synopsis.
You know, people who have listened to Nightcast or my other shows by now realize I can't do short synopses. I try to let the reader know everything that happens in the story as if they don't have the book. And
what did you think of this one?
I really liked it. I first read this in the Essential Werewolf by Night, and as I mentioned, like Werewolf, I love this character. I know it's not the greatest series that Marvel ever published, but it might be my favorite just on a sort of purely subjective personal level. I just had so much fun reading Werewolf by Night. I just have a love for that. So I read the story a long time ago. I've always liked it. I think Werewolf is a weird creature who like just doesn't seem like he fits in the Marvel universe, but can fit as a foil for Spider-Man because Spider-Man's villains often have a quality sort of like him. So yeah, I really liked it. One thing that I did note, Don Perlin, who inked this one, this was his first work with werewolf character, shortly after this, he would become the regular artist for Werewolf by Night, taking over for Mike Ploog.
Oh, cool. All right. I didn't know that. That's neat. The thing, whenever, this isn't related to the story, but when I think of Werewolf by Night, I think of the one story I read in an Amazing Heroes many years ago. You may have heard it. Stop me if you have. But apparently one day, some Marvel lawyers got a call from some film studio, and they wanted to license Werewolf by Night. And the Marvel – and the person writing about it in Amazing Heroes, this is the phrase they used, and I never forgot it. They said, the Marvel lawyers, in a rare moment of honesty, said, you don't have to license this from us. It's just a werewolf. And the guy – and they were like, no, we want this. And he was like, no, you're not listening. It's just a werewolf. You can just do your own werewolf. You don't have to license it. And the guys were like, no, we want Werewolf by Night. Like, okay, well, send the check to 387 Park Avenue South. I just love that idea of some studios like, we got to have that one. We got to have Jack Russell. That's where the money is. Like, okay, fine.
I've heard that before, and I've like always thought of like ways that I would adapt this like Werewolf by Night into a TV series or a movie or something like that, and then it always comes back to it. It's like, you know, why bother? Yeah. Like, the werewolf is in the public domain. Like, why attach yourself to this character? Most people don't know who Jack Russell is. They kind of snicker when they hear the name.
Yeah, of course, right. He's so smart. He can do so many things. He can do a lot of tricks. He's really great. I like the story a lot. It's thoroughly unmysterious. Partly because Ross Andrew just, I don't think, was particularly great at doing mystery. But first of all, his anatomy, second to none.
Yeah.
He himself may be perfect. I don't know. I never saw what he looked like. But in terms of his drawings, his anatomy was perfect. But I loved the way the bit where the waitress meets up with Peter Parker. Just the way that is paced, where she walks in, where Peter's noticing that everybody in the diner is just like a zombie. And the way she walks up to him and then just starts screaming. I don't know. To me, it's like really creepy. People in trances always kind of creep me out a little. And though, so just seeing her look normal and then just start screeching uncontrollably to me is unsettling, even though it's taking place during the day. And then you get the scene later on at night where they're all filing out of the diner and he's watching. It gives me a whole Invasion of the Body Snatchers vibe, especially since this is San Francisco, which is where that movie takes place. And I also really like Moondark. He is a classic 70s Anton LaVey, Alice Cooper, you know, that kind of like Satanist kind of guy. I dig him. His look is very cool. He looks like he could have been in a band. He was like the bassist in Black Sabbath or something. So this story is plus it's got a pentagram. That's always funny. I mean, you know, Marvel was really taking advantage of the loosened comics code to be able to do all this Satanist stuff in the 70s.
Yeah, they were.
It's a good story. I like it a lot. And that's funny. I didn't know that about Don Perlin. So good for him.
He ended up becoming the main artist on the book after Mike Ploog. And I think Ploog was the better artist, but Don Perlin happened to draw more of my favorite stories. Mm-hmm. So if I have to, I tend to favor sort of like the middle of the run that Perlin was working on. But it's tough to choose between them. But.
Mm. I also like that this is Spider-Man reacting to the death of Gwen Stacy and Green Goblin. I mean, this is Marvel team-up. They weren't really doing a lot of intertitle continuity back then. So that's kind of a nice detail that he's like, I just got to clear the cobwebs out of my head and I'm just going to go across the country. Like, that's a nice – it's a nice little detail. I like that a lot.
And they take the time to give you a little bit of the characterization of Jonah and Robbie. Like, Jonah understands why he needs a mental health day, but he's not going to foot the bill for it.
Yeah.
and, of course, Robbie comes up with a diplomatic solution because Robbie actually cares about people. So.
That's right, yeah. Robbie Robertson from the band, of course. We all know.
From the band, yes.
So, that's the second story. And then there's a little one-page interstitial, which is two ads from Not Brand Eck. Now, of course, when I got this comic at the time, I didn't know that there was ever a Not Brand Eck comic. I never heard of it. It was canceled long before I came around. So I thought these were just, you know, new to the treasury. But it doesn't matter. There's so much fun. You can buy – there's an ad for Plastic Muscles, which you can buy, which is just so making fun of comic book fans. I love that. I mean, it's like they're basically saying, you know, anybody who reads this is a 90-pound weakling. And then you can turn yourself into a giant muscle band, and you get Daredevil talking about it. And then the second half is live your own comic book, where you can buy balloons. You can buy different word balloons, and you have it's clobbering time. And there's a goldfish saying Imperious Rex. Submariner's getting hit by a giant conch. You've got old Captain Marvel holding a Shazam sound effect, which I thought was kind of a cheeky little in joke there. I thought that was nice.
Can I just say right there, the original Captain Marvel costume, the green and white one, is like my favorite forgotten superhero costume, because everybody thinks of him in the red and blue sort of superhero costume. But I love the original like Kree warrior green and white costume. That's such a cool look.
It looks very – I mean, green and white is a color scheme not generally seen in comic book uniforms. But I love that the Hulk is holding up Thor's word balloon and Thor is holding up Hulk's word balloon. He's a friend from work. I love all that. It's fantastic. This was what made Marvel so much fun, is that they just didn't take anything seriously. And they were even willing to make fun of their own characters, which was great. I love the little certificate you would have to cut out. And it says, "Pow, I need," and you have to cross off all the things you want. "I enclose my entire life savings." I just love all this. And, of course, it's drawn by Marie Severin, who was a brilliant artist, still is as far as I know. And she was perfect style for this artwork. So I love all these special little extra details in the treasures. They're so much fun.
Me too. And the one up above with the plastic muscles that you can order, like the little cutout where you send it, it's like, "I'd like blank muscle kits," and it gives you like the different options for what type of muscle you want. Your biceps, you know, your tummy, your calves, or your ears or something. I'm sorry. And then it gives you like name, address, zip code. And then like plastered over that, print neat and clear, no blots or whatever. It doesn't give you enough room to actually write your name, address, and zip code.
Yeah, it's just them just having so much fun. So I love it. I absolutely love it. I just think it would have been so much fun to kind of like go back into the vaults and look for little one pagers that you could stick in after they figure out, okay, well, Werewolf by Night is this many pages, and then the X-Men story is this many pages. And we're like, "Oh, we got three extra pages. Let's go look through the old stats of what we have lying around." Yes. what we can put in here. So I absolutely love this stuff. So the next story, Spider-Man and Ghost Rider.
"If an Eye Offend Thee" is reprinted from Marvel Team-Up issue 15. The story is written by Len Wein, penciled by Ross Andrew, inked by Don Perlin, lettered by John Costanza, colored by Glynis Wein, and edited by Roy Thomas. Mary Jane Watson, dressed in the greatest pair of bell-bottom pants ever,
he stole my heart,
brings Peter Parker to Madison Square Garden to attend Ghost Rider's motorcycle extravaganza. After she makes Peter buy the tickets, MJ leads him to their seats in the upper balcony. When the show begins, the star attraction rides out on a motorcycle, dressed in black leather, his head a flaming skull. Johnny Blaze lets the applause wash over him, a feeling he has not enjoyed since his mentor and father figure, Crash Simpson, died, and Johnny became the hellish Ghost Rider. Peter allows himself to settle and enjoy the spectacle, though he's most impressed by the makeup job giving Ghost Rider his uncanny appearance. The Ghost Rider performs his latest thrilling stunt, the Headman's Run, where he jumps his bike over four other riders, coming dangerously close to each rider's helmet. The stunt brings the crowd, including Peter and Mary Jane, to their feet, cheering. One of the four riders in the stunt removes her helmet, revealing herself to be Roxanne Simpson, daughter of Crash, the man who owned the motorcycle show before his death. She also happens to be the love of Johnny Blaze's life. Just then, the show is interrupted by a second gang of bikers riding onto the floor of the garden past security guards. The gang's leader, who calls himself the Orb, wears a helmet shaped like a giant eyeball. A cop draws his weapon and tells the Orb to put his hands up. The biker turns toward the cop. The iris and pupil of the massive eyeball helmet stares right at the cop and transfixes him. The Orb commands the cop to put his gun away, and the officer does as though he cannot control his own hands. Ghost Rider revs his bike, ready to haul off and confront the new bikers, but Roxanne urges caution. The Orb rides around the perimeter of the arena, and wherever he stares, people in the crowd become mesmerized. Peter Parker, feeling his spider sense tingle, looks away at the last minute to avoid being caught in the Orb's spell. Mary Jane, however, is hypnotized. Between the people mesmerized by the Orb and the others focused on what's happening in the arena, neither Mary Jane nor anybody else notices Peter shoot a web up to the rafters of the balcony, climbing up there and changing into his Spider-Man costume. Ghost Rider rides off for the Orb, but his gang surrounds the rider and boxes him out, while the Orb swings around and grabs Roxanne, carrying her off. Ghost Rider tries to give chase, but the Orb's biker gang keeps him locked out. He tries to blast them with his Hellfire, but they dodge his attacks. Then Spider-Man swings down from the rafters and kicks one of the bikers off his ride. While Spider-Man fights with the rest of the gang, Ghost Rider shoots the gap in the biker's blockade and races after the Orb and the captured Roxanne. But the Orb has a contingency plan. He commands the spectators in the audience, those already under his spell, to walk out into the arena. With no regard for their own safety, dozens of innocent civilians walk out into the path between Ghost Rider and the orb. Ghost Rider dumps his bike to avoid hitting anyone. Spidey tries to web swing over the crowd to reach the orb and his hostage, but Ghost Rider hellfire blasts the web, forcing Spider-Man to fall back to the ground. Ghost Rider tells the wall crawler that Rocky is his love and his responsibility to rescue. But before they can get into a nuanced debate about that, the crowd of people still under the orb's thrall begin to speak as one. They address their message to Johnny Blaze, speaking the orb's words from their own mouths. They tell him the orb will release Roxanne Simpson in exchange for total control over the motorcycle stunt show. Elsewhere, the orb and his gang bring Roxanne back to his hidden underground hideout. She asks who he is and what he wants. The orb says his name is Drake Shannon, and that he used to be the partner of her father, Crash. They were best friends, but soon their relationship fell apart as Drake thought Crash was too cautious with the business and Crash thought Drake too reckless. With a stunt show and with his own riding. They could no longer work together, but neither wanted to give up the business, so they arranged a contest. Crash and Drake would race across the country on their motorcycles. The winner keeps the bike show. At the end of the race, as both bikers neared the finish line, Shannon tried to cheat by forcing Crash off the road. He swerved into Crash's path, but it was he who lost control. Drake was thrown from the bike and slid across 25 yards of pavement on his face. Crash Simpson visited Drake in the hospital, but the man was too full of rage to accept his presence. He swore to Crash that one day he would have the motorcycle show. When the hospital released Drake Shannon, his face was so disfigured that no one would look at him, until a mysterious group offered to train him and give him the helmet with the hypnotic eye. Roxanne tells him he cannot simply steal the motorcycle show, but the orb tells her it's what he deserves for his suffering. And to punctuate the point, he takes his helmet off, revealing his horribly mangled face. At that moment, Ghost Rider appears, having used his supernatural powers to free the hypnotized crowd and track the orb back to his hideout. Drake puts his helmet back on while Ghost Rider hands him the ownership papers of the bike show. Ghost Rider starts to leave with Rocky, but the orb's men draw their guns on the two. That's when Spider-Man arrives, disarming the gang with his web shooters and kicking two of them. The orb grabs Roxanne again and rides off on his motorcycle down the tunnel. Spider-Man and Ghost Rider finish mopping up the gang and then mount their own motorcycles and give chase. The orb fires a laser gun back at his pursuers but cannot get a good shot. He rides the tunnel out to its opening at Grand Central Station. The three motorcyclists race around, trying to get the edge on each other. Finally, Ghost Rider is able to blast the orb with hellfire, enough that his grip on Rocky loosens and Spider-Man is able to catch her with his web and pull her away from the orb's bike. Without a hostage, the orb races desperately back into the tunnels. Spider-Man tells Ghost Rider to go after him while he stays with Roxanne. Ghost Rider chases the orb into the subway tunnel, but an oncoming train bears down on them. The orb screams as he appears to be run over by the train, but Ghost Rider leaps from his bike to avoid getting crushed. Ghost Rider returns to Grand Central to find Spider-Man and Roxanne. He holds the ownership papers for the bike show, which he tells them are forgeries, and sets them on fire. The rider and his girlfriend walk off together, while Spider-Man swings away to his next adventure.
There are so many details about this that I love, but I got to get right to the meat of this. The reveal of the orb's face. It is one of the great moments to be in all of superhero comics. This had such a big impact on me as a kid, no pun intended, for the orb. Like, to me, this is the comic book version of the Phantom of the Opera reveal in the silent film. I mean, this scared the living bejesus out of me. This giant close-up, and believe me, it'll be part of the gallery post, the big close-up of the orb's hideous face. It is so friggin' hideous. I just love it. It's beautiful. It's just beautiful.
And it wonderfully contrasts with the first page in the story with Mary Jane in those pants.
Oh, she is just, she's in a halter top. She's got the platform shoes. She is just Peter, come on, you know? Oh, she's so beautiful. She's so beautiful in this story. It's just great. It's so much fun. There's so many details of it. I just love Mary Jane, the way she sort of makes fun of Peter. Like, that's, mm-hmm. I think, like, that sort of turns me on. Maybe get into too much of that. But I like that. I love the orb's costume. Like, his helmet, it's just the giant eyeball. That's creepy in its own way. Again, the reveal is great. I love his whole MO, I think, is fantastic. I love the detail of when Ghost Rider slips to Spider-Man. By the way, I'm not wearing a mask. Mm-hmm. And Spider-Man's like, huh? Like, I love that. That's a great little detail. It's just a fun story. It's just a really, really fun story. I mean, Ghost Rider, again, not a character that you think necessarily works well with other characters, even though he was a member of a super team, of course. But him and Spidey are just like a cool little combo.
Yeah, they are, yeah. Yeah, the orb. On the face of it, it seems so silly. It seems preposterous.
No pun intended.
Yeah, that his head is just a big eyeball.
Great.
But there's something so, like, just cool about it. If you just buy into these are superhero comics. It's just, it's wonderful. And he's got, like, this red kind of classic outfit, like, with the big, like, the pants that sit, have the kind of military cut. Like, it just looks cool. And then, yeah, when he takes it off, this horrific face and everything. And he's just he's a motorcycle driver. So he's, like, this perfect anti-Ghost Rider character.
Yeah.
I love this. This is the character's first appearance. He did come back in Ghost Rider issue 14.
Oh, did he? Oh, cool.
I think there have been more than one character to go by the name of the Orb.
That's not right. There's one Orb, damn it.
I know. But this one, I think, came back in Ghost Rider 14, and I meant to check because I think I have the essential Ghost Rider that has that issue.
Okay.
I meant to check if they revealed how he survived, and I forgot to do that. So if anybody is listening and they happen to know that weird bit of information, please let us know. And yeah, like, Jason Aaron must have loved this story because he actually used the orb as the one of the focal characters of a recent Marvel event that Original Sin that just came out like
really?
2 years ago. The orb was a major character of that
what?
Story.
Oh yes. My god. That's great. I love it. I love that the orb is a big deal. If you take Spider-Man out of this story, this could really be like a Vincent Price like horror movie about a guy who is getting revenge on his, you know, his business partner, and he's been scarred. I mean, it's got that same beat to it, and they said the reveal is just so Phantom of the Opera. I mean, that's just what it is. So, I mean, and of course, you know, Hammer was dabbling in sort of biker movies in the 70s and trying to introduce some mod elements to the horror movie. So you really, this has got all, it's Marvel is taking full advantage of the comics code being loosened. We talked about in the previous story. They really dug into this deeply.
Oh, and they did it so well, too. Yeah, like, I tell you, like, back when we talked about the first episode of Midnight the Podcasting Hour, I came very close to doing a Marvel horror podcast, and this makes me think I need to do that at some point. The page, it's 53 on the Treasury, the page with the reveal of his face. Even the page before that, when you see how he fell off the bike, just going down and just, like, The way he describes it, his narration, at 95 miles an hour, my motorcycle threw me, Roxanne, and my momentum sent me scuttering along the tarmac for more than 25 yards on my face.
Oh, man, it's fantastic. It's so good. And then you cut to him looking like a mummy in the next panel, and then you see him on the streets, and people are, you know, like, you know, because he's so hideous. And it's just that review, that panel is so good.
Right.
It's just so good.
It's just classic. Like, at this point, it doesn't even matter if he was a nasty person in his previous life, like, because of how the horror that his life has become with that face. Like, it reminds me of a line from the cartoon Aqua Teen Hunger Force, where it's, if I woke up looking like that, I would just run towards the nearest living thing and kill it.
I'm glad the orb has continued on.
Yes,
it's a great character. He's super. Oh, I love it. I just love it. That panel. Oh, my God.
I also looked up just another detail sort of for the context because, you know, Spider-Man doesn't know anything about Ghost Rider at this point. This issue of Marvel Team-Up came out between Ghost Rider issue 2 and 3. Now, Ghost Rider didn't premiere with Ghost Rider 1. He'd kind of spin it around. But so this was early on, and it was right around the time he got the power to create a motorcycle out of Hellfire. Because until I read this story, I didn't know that he could actually shoot Hellfire, like, as a blast with his hand, so I don't know if that was a new thing for him. But I don't know how often that was actually used, or if that was just an invention for this story.
How does Ghost Rider talk? He doesn't have vocal cords. How does he talk? He doesn't. His mouth can't make sounds. I mean, I guess it's, you know,
it's magic. It's
comics, yeah. It's, you know, but I mean, he's pretty loquacious for a guy that doesn't have a tongue or anything. He's just jabbing on. So I'm like, okay, all right, fine.
And again, just from my age, like, you know, I liked Ghost Rider in the 90s when I was getting into comics, and he had the more, you know, hardcore leather biker jacket with the chains and everything like that. But I've come to like kind of reject that, and I really like this one where it's like a little bit more of a superhero costume, but it's more of like a racing outfit, like a stunt performer outfit. That you still see the black leather, but there's a kind of symmetry to it. It doesn't look like he's got like spikes on his shoulders, like he's like a reject from Hell's Angels or something like that. No, he's a performer.
Yeah.
That just happens to have this like ghastly like look. It's just, again, it's very 70s. It's not trying to be cool. It's cool because it's what it is.
Yeah. Oh, man. And it's, if I was Peter, I would not be bothering to be Spider-Man. I would just be taking Mary Jane out to whatever she wanted. I wouldn't care. She's such a groovy chick. I just love her.
Yeah. It sort of reminds, like, just in the recent years, there's been such a love affair with Gwen Stacy and bringing her back, and we sort of just remembering her time, like, with rose-tinted glasses. And I just remember Jerry Connelly saying, it's like, you know, we killed her because she was the boring one. It's like, when you looked at Gwen and you looked at Mary Jane was the fun one. She was so much cooler. She was the one you wanted to hang out with. That's why we offed Gwen Stacy.
Yeah. Oh, so terrific. Just love her. So yeah, it's a great. These are all really good stories. And whoever put this together, there's a couple different names on the indicia about who's the editor here. I don't know. I mean, it says it's Jim Shooter is the editor in chief, and then Jim Salicrup is reliable reprint editor. So I'm going to guess it's him. Well done, Jim Salicrup, because these are really solid stories. They're all really interesting. So we have a couple more puzzle pages, which I love. There's Puzzle Fun, which is Count the Aliens, which is a simple thing. And then there's a What's Wrong with This Picture, which has a million different things of Silver Surfer and Doctor Doom and Aunt May dressed as Spider-Man. It's all just very, very silly. Then there's a Connect the Dots, where Galactus is chasing Silver Surfer. There's a coloring book section where you can color by numbers. And I love the idea that, like, the Thing is colored different numbers, even though, of course, he's all just one color. But if you look closely, it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
They're all miscolored, too. Yeah. And, even if you weren't paying attention, I know that because in my copy, somebody colored it. Like, with, like, colored pencil or crayon or something like that. So somebody colored, and Captain America is primarily red with blue stripes on his chest and blue boots. Spider-Man, they must have ignored it and colored him the right colors, but like it looks like they started to color Thing and then they realized, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense, and just quit.
Kid was like, what am I doing? I love that even on this little at the very bottom corner, there's the page number and it says, don't color this, dum-dum, it's a page number. What I love is that they changed the page number to match the page number for the Treasury, which is page 61. Because, of course, whatever this first appeared in is probably, you know, another not brand deck. That's probably like page 7 or something. So they actually took the time to change the page number just for the gag, which I appreciate that level of effort. So, and then there's a puzzle, a maze, where you have to have the Fantastic Four try and find their little child, which is just invariably cute. I love it.
And also the easiest maze to possibly solve.
Because they all lead. They all lead to the little kid. I love that. And then there's a match the pair most similar. And then it's Gwen Stacy, Sari Jane Watson, Beatrix Smirk, Pamela Chick, Hilda Iceberg, and Virginia Pipeline. And it's the same drawing statted 6 times with just different hair colors. It's just Marvel's very Monty Python and just messing with your head. I love doing that kind of stuff.
Virginia Pipeline sounds like a porno actress.
It sure does. Yeah. It's great. I love it. I just love it so much. So the final story is Spider-Man and TV star Iron Fist. And the title is For Few Fists More. I think you know where Jerry got that from. It's by Jerry Conway, Jim Mooney, Vince Coletta, Artie Simek, Petra G. I forget who that is. Petra Scalise, I think was the name of the colorist. I don't think they list her last name here. And Len Wein, and it's from Marvel Team Up number 31. Now, this story starts as a flashback of Peter Parker relating to the events of what happened. So it starts, and Peter Parker's catching a bite to eat in a greasy spoon when the door is busted down by a knife-wielding thug smashing through it, thanks to a sharp kick from Iron Fist. After the thug is subdued, Iron Fist simply walks away. Parker chases after him, but Iron Fist never breaks stride. Slipping into his Spider-Man costume, little does Spidey know, but he himself is being watched by a strangely costumed man who speaks backwards. Ryan, speaks backwards. It's your thing, man.
I'll have a thought or two about that by the end of
Okay. The man speaks of needing the energy he can grab from one costumed hero, so two would be even better. He zaps Spidey's web line with a ray gun, causing him to land on Iron Fist. This, of course, leads to a fight between the two, while the mystery man, named Drom, watches on. Finally, Iron Fist calms down enough to listen to reason. They wander to a nearby park and compare notes, while Drom grows frustrated. As they talk, a multi-armed creature emerges from a nearby sand pit and attacks Spider-Man and Iron Fist. Spider-Man destroys the creature and then sees Drom nearby. He zaps Drom with a shot of webbing, only to watch it turn to dust as it gets close to Drom's face. Drom then zaps Spider-Man, and Spider-Man soon wakes up in Drom's lair, strapped to a chair. Drom explains he suffers from a bizarre affliction that causes him to age in reverse, the whole Benjamin Button thing. Within moments of being born, his body turned old, and he's been getting younger ever since. Not being able to eat food thanks to his reversed metabolism, he needs pure energy to survive, energy he steals from other humans. Drom hopes that the energy from someone like Spider-Man might be so great it will halt his affliction rather than just slow it. Before he can finish talking, Iron Fist bursts in. If anyone touches Drom, they turn to dust, so our heroes cannot attack Drom directly. They instead grab a giant mirror and smash it over Drom's head, causing him to collapse. They then watch as he grows younger and younger, eventually disappearing into nothingness, leaving only his uniform. Later, Spidey and Iron Fist walk home, pondering the idea of how long memories last if there is no one around to hold them. We find Peter Parker making a tape recording of this adventure, but then he begins to forget that he even met Iron Fist at all, and he was wondering why he was even recording in the first place. What did you think of this?
Well, like the Iron Fist Netflix TV show, I think this is the weakest of the bunch. Which isn't to say it's bad. It's got some things that I like, but I do think it was weak. The story is kind of meh, and the art on its own would probably be fine and serviceable, but compared to who we've been looking at before with Ross Andrew and Gil Kane, it doesn't really compare. What did you think of this one?
Drom just was not a great villain to me, particularly. That's really a big part of it. I kind of like Iron Fist just walking through New York, subduing guys and smashing through, and then he just leaves. Like, I love that idea. Like, that's really fun. And I like that Spider-Man and Iron Fist just talk it over. And they just wander to a nearby park, and they just sit and they talk. It's like, that's New York in the 70s. It's just a guy, and, you know, two guys in masks just talking about stuff, just kicking around, kicking ideas around, you know. Don't need to get stressful. Yeah, Drom is just such, to me, such a kind of zero villain that it just doesn't have a whole lot of oomph to it. And, you know, the whole idea of you get to see Drom as a baby when he's an old man, which is creepy and weird. I've never seen the Benjamin Button movie, so I'm not sure how they visualized it, if it was something similar. But that, to me, it's upsetting to look at, like, you know, an old man in a nursery. Like, that's mm-hmm. just creepy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, yeah, I agree. I don't think he was – I think they had this idea for this kind of gimmick villain of everything, like, going backwards. And I don't know if they just didn't figure out how to realize it well, or if this is actually the only way to kind of realize it, and it just proves to be not a great idea. But, like, the talking backwards stuff, like, this is coming from a guy who has a Zatanna podcast right. and loves Zatanna. I don't like the gimmick of talking backwards. I don't like forcing your reader to work needlessly harder to understand what's going on with the story. Now, in most cases, I think Zatanna gets away with it with the backwards speech because there is an automatic visual component, like right. because of the right. art. Usually when she's speaking backwards, she's casting a spell that has a physical transformation that if the artist and the storyteller are working in concert, you don't need to actually read her dialogue to know what she's saying because just look at it and something has happened. The butterflies have turned into elephants or whatever, or vice versa. This is a case where he's not accomplishing anything. He's just speaking backwards, and the writer and the letterer have to go out of their way to translate it all for you. And it's like, you're just making this frustrating for no reason. And it's okay, so why does he talk backwards? And we get to everything about him is backwards. Like, okay, it makes sense, but it's not that interesting. Not as interesting as you thought it was when you were coming up with a story. So
yeah, after two footnotes, Jerry actually steps in and he says, he translates the backwards, and then he says, "Note: hereafter, we'll just give you the translations and save the originals for our memory book." Like, even he's admitting, "Yeah, all right, you're gonna get tired of reading this." So
yeah, yeah. So I like the idea of Spider-Man and Iron Fist teaming up. I like their scenes when they're together, either fighting or just hanging out and talking. I think the more or less the plot of the story with the villain is kind of throwaway and dispensable.
Yeah, and any story that ends with everybody forgetting what happened kind of leads you to that. You're like, well, then, all right, why did we go on this journey then? You know. At the same time, I like the visions of New York at night in the 70s. I mean, if you've ever read a lot of interviews with or some interviews with the guys that worked at Marvel in the 70s, they did a lot of that. They walked around New York together, pitching ideas to one another. You know, they all hung out. And they would all, you know, Gerber and Tony Isabella and Jerry Conway and Lynn Wein and all these guys, they socialized. And a lot of times they lived in apartments together and they kicked around ideas. And so when I'm watching Spider-Man and Iron Fist walking in New York in the middle of the night and there's nobody around, to me that's these guys. You know, this is what their life was sort of like at the time. I do like the detail of it's the last page of the story where we see Iron Fist and Spider-Man coming out, and there's like a ton of garbage on the street. And you're like, well, that's New York in the 70s. That's a rare piece of detail that Vince Coletta did not erase from the original pencils. He bothered to leave it in. So, and I always like Iron Fist. I have not watched the series yet just because I haven't heard much good things about it, but I always liked Iron Fist. I like Power Man and Iron Fist together. So, I just think Iron Fist has a great costume, and it's like that. It's always neat to look at. And we got to get the fight between two of them. Like you said, it's fine. It's fine. It's not bad. It's just compared to the other three, it's a little lesser than the other.
Right.
But you know what? Hey, it's $2. You got a ton of great material here. Let's not
absolutely.
Yeah, great stuff. So on the inside cover is a presenting a peek at Aunt May's photo album. And that means it's photos from the Spider-Man TV show. And there's two shots of Spidey in action and then one shot of Nicholas Hammond as Peter Parker.
I had no idea that Fox News personality Tucker Carlson played Peter Parker.
Oh, God. Oh, don't insult Nicholas Hammond like that. What's the matter with you? Nicholas Hammond was his other big credit, really, is The Sound of Music. That's really – he was one of the kids in The Sound of Music. So, he's not Tucker Carlson. Please, Ryan.
I think it looks a lot like him, though.
All right. I don't know why you're picking on Nicholas Hammond.
Maybe I'm picking on Tucker Carlson's haircut because he looks like he's in the 70s.
Maybe so. I don't – you'll have to see if – Let's look at it anyway. But again, this is another one of those great little bonus features that DC used to do all the time, you know, with their movie serial characters or whatever. Mm-hmm. So here's Marvel getting to do that too. Yep. I mean, they right on the cover of this book, it says Spider-Man is Marvel's TV sensation.
Yeah.
So they were already, you know, playing up that whole notion. And basically the last run of Treasuries from 18 through 27 is mostly just Spider-Man and Hulk. At that point, just trading back and forth because those were their TV stars, you know. They decided to just basically just hand the treasuries over to their two biggest stars. So the back cover is again by Bob Budiansky and Ernie Chan, and it's a reverse of the front cover, except this time we've got the villains, and they're in like some squalid alley, and there's garbage, and there's a rat, and they're all dealing with the fact that Spider-Man is shooting his sort of like spider signal on them. And I guess that the spider signal didn't get used a lot because I guess it's so similar to the bat signal. But I always dug the spider signal. I think it's a cool visual.
Yeah, I think the bat signal sort of is, you know, has that the function of, you know, calling Batman to the station. This feels like a cool sort of take on like a police spotlight.
Yeah,
like this is Spider-Man catching them in the act. So I can understand somebody just saying, oh, it's just like a bat signal. It's like, well, functionally, it's not like that at all. I do like the idea. There's a cuteness to it, and there's a kind of old fashioned charm. I like that they kind of played around with that with the post credit stinger for Captain America: Civil War had like an homage to that.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I think it was terrific. I even think there was a toy, like a Spider-Man utility belt that you could shine this. Like it you literally came with like a little flashlight and you could do it. I never had it, but I think I remember seeing an ad for that because and I dig it. And again, it's a nice reversal of the front cover of just the villains all going like, yeah. And if I was Morbius, I'd be like, really? I got to pose with these zeros? You know, Moondark and Drom? I mean, come on, man. I'm clearly the big draw here. I've been in a lot of comics.
I've got my own series a couple times.
Yeah, I mean, jeez. Yeah.
But actually, three of these guys look really cool together. Morbius, Moondark, and Orb
together.
They look like a cool, evil, supernatural team. with the other guy that we'll quickly forget about.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It's good. It's really terrific. And it makes a great package. This is I think this is one of Marvel's best treasuries. I mean, I have, of course, my deep personal childhood connection to it, but I think it's a really good collection of stories sandwiched between two very handsome covers featuring some cool bonus material. What else do you want out of a treasury comic?
Like I said, I mean, this was I came to this relatively recently, only about a year ago, but I saw the cover to this a long time ago, and I always thought this had to be a great story, or whatever this was packaged with had to be exciting, and it did not disappoint me. When I actually flipped through and read this, I was like, this was totally worth it. This was such a blast to read.
Awesome.
I had a lot of fun with this.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. That's super cool. So, yeah, it's a really, really good, fun book. Marvel Treasury Edition number 18. So, Ryan, before we sign off and get into our various plugs and stuff, I need to ask you the question I ask of all new guests. You're familiar with doing this on the reverse side, of course, Star Wars. I would ask you, the two questions are, what Treasury Edition everybody seems to think I'm only talking about DC. I'm not. Anybody should have done. What Treasury Edition should there have been? There never was. The one answer I take off the table is Wonder Woman, because that's the obvious answer. But I mean, like, what, you know, is there some character that you think deserved a treasury and never got one? And then the second question is, if you could print a treasury completely free of any commercial, you know, instincts or worries, what would you have done?
Well, my answers are going to lean towards DC anyway, because that's just where my mind has been for a while. The first question, which treasury am I surprised that they never did? This one came to me very quickly, and it's Swamp Thing.
Yes.
And the reason for that is, for one thing, how badly would you love to see Bernie Wrightson's work blown up to that scale?
Oh, man.
But also because that material, like the first couple of issues of Swamp Thing, and like they reprinted that so often and in other formats. You know, they had like the DC Special series would reprint the Bernie Wrightson Swamp Thing stories. They did a couple of trade paperbacks kind of early on in their life, and eventually they did the digest size, you know, collection of those first 10 issues. So it seems like, I mean, they knew how popular that story was. They knew how good, like they kept on reprinting that. I'm just surprised that they didn't reprint it as a treasury size, because that would have been fantastic to have the first two or three issues of Swamp Thing plus the short story from House of Secrets.
Oh, like, man, yeah.
That would have been great. So that's the one that surprises me that they never did, because it just seems like kind of obvious. In terms of, like, if money was no object, if I could just have my wish, there are a few things. And I, again, thinking about the treasury, the oversized format, what it would be for an artist's, you know, a showcase. If I'm just talking about reprint material, I would love to do something that I'm not really familiar with, but would be like a war anthology book, like collecting stories of Sergeant Rock, The Losers, Enemy Ace, Haunted Tank, some of that stuff, you know, get a lot of good Joe Kubert work. Or, and this came to me after listening to you talk about the Fantastic Four one, just more Jack Kirby, so maybe stuff is from the New Gods or the Fourth One. Would look great. That's if I was doing a reprint. If I'm doing a brand new material, original content, an original tale of the Justice League of America set in the satellite era, drawn by Carl Kerschel. And this comes to me because for any of you, if you have seen the cover to the Justice League of America Bronze Age Omnibus, or the Batman, the Brave, and the Bold Bronze Age Omnibus, the new giant hardcover collections that they've released. Carl Kerschel does the cover art, and his renditions of those classic characters look so good. The JLA Omnibus has Superman, Batman, Green Arrow, Flash, the Atom, Black Canary, and Hawkman, and they look so good. And you look at that, and you're just like, why can't that era of the League still exist? Why can't we have more stories from that time period? And I would love to see like an original story, like a big 100-pager or some epic showdown with that group drawn by Carl Kerschel, because I think he's got a great look for those characters.
Good answer. Those covers are beautiful. I like that Justice League cover, even though Aquaman is not on it. It really is quite nice. And, you know, like I said, I keep hoping DC will get back in that business, because Marvel's doing them again. So come on, guys. You know?
Here's hoping.
Not like you don't have a Justice League movie coming out anytime soon. So great answers. Those are all just beautiful ideas. And yeah, I would have loved to have seen a war collection, a war is hell Treasury Edition, Unknown Soldier, and all those.
Do you have much experience with Joe Kubert? I don't know if you know like a lot of his work or anything.
I'm vaguely familiar. Okay. Just occasionally, you know, he called me son once. And I don't want to get into it. He had a lot of kids. He may have just been confused. I don't know.
Sure.
So anyway, well, Ryan, thank you so much for coming on Treasury Cast, man. This was a ton of fun. I'm so happy to talk about this one. This is such a beloved comic to me. I still have that sense memory of being a little kid and buying it, kneeling down and picking this up. And so many other memories have faded over time. I have girlfriends I can barely remember, but I still can remember buying this one off the stands and sitting on the porch of our cabin and reading this comic. And it's just such a beloved item. And I'm glad that you really liked it. I'm glad even as a quote unquote grown up, you really liked it.
No, I did. I had a blast reading this one, and it was great talking about it too.
All right. Where can people find you on the internet?
A number of shows here on the Fire and Water Podcast website or network. Batman Nightcast, Midnight the Podcasting Hour, Give Me Those Star Wars, and Power of Fishnets, the Black Canary and Zatanna podcast. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter at RyanDaily01. Just, you know, hanging out. Follow me.
Okay.
I'm fun. I make a lot of, like, witty comments and stuff.
That's true. And the man has a baby on the way. He needs Twitter followers. I don't know how that works out, but it just does.
So. Yeah, my tweets are going to become a lot more frequent and a lot less coherent after the summer. Just it won't stop crying.
It's going to be an interesting real-time experiment to watch you slowly break down, kind of like Drom. Like you just sort of just turned into dust eventually, just disappeared.
Look for a new show coming this fall, the New Dad Podcast with Ryan Daly, which is just me screaming for 10 minutes about what horrible lesson I learned about parenthood that day.
So. I look forward to it. We'll make room for that on the network. So, well, anyway, thanks everybody for listening. Now, stay tuned for some podcast promos, and when we come back, we are going to do listener feedback.
Another great show wrapped.
Sure was.
Now, time to move on to our serious business. Time for the monthly team meeting. So, Team WFD, roll call, activate. Host, Mike.
I'm here, bro.
Webmaster, Doug.
Hey, everybody.
Kapow. Tech support, Rifty. Huzzah, it is I, Rifty. Ascendient Twitter account, Wilfred.
Hello, humans.
And me, other host, Paul. Okay, everyone present. Now let's look at our upcoming schedule because we've got some big things coming up. I think our first order of business should be the news segment. Thoughts?
Is the news segment about my triumphant return to your world?
What the f***?
Holy s***.
Son of a...
Who let the candle maker in here? Well, Fred?
There are far too many humans on this show. I'm just trying to balance things out.
Look, I'm sorry, Candlemaker. There's nothing really for you in the upcoming episodes. Plus, let's be honest, you had your 15 minutes.
What? How dare you? I'm King Candor.
Yeah, whatever. Look, we've got a new segment launching. We've got some guests planned, Jail May 2 to look forward to, not to mention our 100th episode coming up, and we really don't have room for you. I'm sorry.
But what? Fine. Whatever. You mortals and your show suck.
Oh, yeah? Well, we might suck, but we can still blow you out just like Dorothy the Ape-Face Girl did.
Yeah, in your face, King Candle.
Oh, ha-ha. Very funny. Bye, losers. See you in hell.
Man, that guy was a jerk.
We're doomed.
Waiting for Doom, the world's greatest Doom Patrol podcast, available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Podbean.com.
It's midnight, the podcasting hour. Hello, listeners. It's your friend, PJ Frightful. That's PJ, as in podcast jockey. And I'm dropping dreadful new episodes every 2 weeks. When the clock strikes midnight, the podcasting hour shines a candle on the dark corners of DC Comics. Those supernatural sagas of Swamp Thing, Dead Man, The Spectre, and more. The Podcasting Hour. It's a rotating anthology series boasting the terrifying talents of Ryan Daly, Rob Kelly, Paul Hicks, Ben Avery, Doug Zavisha, and other unfortunate souls. Prepare for the unexpected, open a doorway to nightmare, and enter the houses of mystery and secrets. The moon is full, and the dark spirits are rising. For it's midnight, the podcasting hour. Coming this Halloween, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Beware.
And we're back for listener feedback, as promised. We don't have any new iTunes reviews, unfortunately, so we're going to jump right to the comments on the website, which is, of course, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we're talking about episode 11, which was Superman and His Incredible Fortress of Solitude, featuring Mike Bailey. First comment is from Dr. Ange. He says, love this one for its insanity. The personal rooms are a bit odd. The space arc is nuts. How often does Superman review and update the list of people he is saving? I'm imagining, Ange, that it changes depending on his mood, like after somebody pisses him off. Like he's, you know, he's mentally going like, and just crosses off the name. One thing we can be sure of, Green Arrow never had a chance for the cosmic arc. Thank you for the comment. David Ace Gutierrez says, I had no idea you weren't a Superman fan, Rob. I'm sad to learn that, I have to admit. I don't know. Maybe I overstated it. It was just one of those things that, you know, in terms of solo comics, I never was that interested in Superman. Now, you know, to be fair, I was sitting, you know, hitting Superman in the mid-70s and early 80s, which I think probably even a lot of Superman fans might admit was one of his fallow periods. Maybe if I'd come along earlier or a little later. I certainly read all the John Byrne stuff. When Byrne took over, I bought all the Superman comics. I was buying Action and Adventures and Superman. So maybe it was just you know, this is the weird time period that I hit him on. But I always like Superman in DC Comics Presents and in Justice League, as I said. So I liked him with other heroes. But I really do love this comic because it is so goofy. My podcasting life mate Chag says, awesome episode. The Bronze Age is such wacky fun. It's the same reason I hated that era of Superman as a kid, but I'm finding it intriguing as an adult. So yeah, that's kind of what I was talking about. He says, regarding Batman podcasts, is there one dedicated to just Elseworlds? That would be fascinating listening. I don't know of one, but there must be at this point, because I think every single iteration of Batman's existence is covered in podcast form, so there must be an Elseworlds Batman. And I know I talked about the Holy Terror Elseworlds story that Alan Brenner wrote when I interviewed him for Fire and Water, but yeah, there must be a whole podcast devoted to, you know, Gotham by Gaslight and all the other ones. Martin Gray says, from Too Dangerous from a Girl blog, says, great show, and I agree with everybody. Ross Andrew was majorly underrated. I don't think covers were his forte, despite him being the main cover artist on the Superman books around this time, but his interiors have a real vibrancy. He and inker Mike Esposito had a terrific synergy. I completely agree with that. The Fortress of Solitude Treasury was released on my birthday, June 18, which was also Superman's Earth Day, the day that Kent celebrated instead of his birthday, which they never knew was February 29. I like to think that was deliberate. I don't think I knew any of that stuff, about your birthday or any of that stuff, so that's fun details. Thank you, Martin. Michelle Fief says, wow, I've never even seen this. I need to own this now, all caps. I love Andrew, and even though he's drawn a million DC covers, his actual Superman comics work is not as common as you'd think. My heart broke a little when I recently discovered that Neil Adams touched up his Superman drawing in the Spidey crossover. The nerve of that guy. You know Ross Andrew's a master when even Gil Kane has gone on the record as saying that Andrew's anatomy is 100% perfect all the time. My God, that back cover is killer. Yeah, I agree with all that, Michelle. Yeah, I mean, Andrew drew characters in these funky positions, and only someone with a complete mastery of anatomy would even bother with that. I tried to spend some time, of course, in my early years drawing comic book style art, and I just couldn't do it. I mean, to me, just drawing a foreshortened hand was impossible, let alone all the crazy positions Andrew put in. So the guy knew his stuff. J. Kevin Carrier says, I am loving the Treasury Cast guys, a great addition to your lineup. Thank you, J. Kevin. I bought a lot of the DC Marvel tabloids back in the day, but the Fortress of Solitude book was one I had missed. I always assumed it was just a collection of Fortress-themed reprints, not an all-new story. Now I really want to read it, especially after seeing some of that sweet Ross Andrew art. Everybody's loving the Ross Andrew. That's great. Chris Franklin from our network says, listening now, but I wanted to say up front, I did buy this off the stands right around the same time at the Superman 2 Treasury. For some reason, this issue got lost to time, and I don't have it anymore. I think a stack of treasuries bit the dust in a clean-out accidentally because my Superman Shazam book is also MIA. That's awful. That's terrible. Of all the books to lose would be your treasures. Chris later came back and listened to the show, and he said, I'm glad you brought up World's Finest number 271 because this feels like a very similar project. Give the comics history buff the job of straightening up the shelves and making things presentable. It's kind of an anti-reboot in a lot of ways. The discussion about school book fairs got me to thinking. My kid's school still has these, and we even purchased a few of the Marvel Adventures Digest there. What a perfect place for the new treasuries. The price point isn't any steeper than the DK reference books that are all over the place at these sales, so I think it's a no-brainer for Marvel and DC to get into this venue. Chris, I'd never even thought of that, but that's a great idea. Can you imagine being a kid and seeing a treasury-sized comic, like a Guardians of the Galaxy treasury or a Spider-Man treasury, at your school book fair? That's great. That, I don't know how DC or Marvel get that stuff in there, but that's a terrific idea, Chris. I hope that somebody hears this and takes them up on it. That's terrific. Ward Hill Terry says, nice job. I've got this one. Bought it fresh off the stands back then. Even then, the story of the artifacts in the fortress struck me as old hat from another era. However, I liked being able to fill in the gaps with references to Superman stories I had not read. I didn't know that previously that Action Comics number 500, one of my favorites, was meant to be a treasury. Thank you, Ward. I was like, I can dispense new information. As you were giving the synopsis, I was thinking about this Superman. My Superman. The Thinker. He's got a mystery to solve, and he does it methodically. Along the way, we are exposed to other facets. Superman the Engineer, Superman the Curious, Superman the Collector, Superman the Grateful, Superman the Caretaker and Cataloger, Superman the Big Hearted. Even the way he solves this mystery, by taking a break and letting his mind wander from a subject at hand, Superman the Zen Master. That's why I like this guy. Yeah, I like that, and I've mentioned that on the comments over on Nightcast, where, you know, the 80s Batman, the early, mid to 80s Batman is the Batman I like, because he's the thinker, he's a true detective, and eventually he morphed into just being the world's greatest facebreaker, and I think Superman kind of became that too, although I haven't really read a lot of Superman comics post the John Byrne era. But yeah, I like that idea that Superman has all these different facets. You didn't mention, but even Superman the artist. Of course, we see that he paints. So I think that's a nice little detail too. Yeah, it's a nice rounded version of the character. Sphinx Magoo says, great episode. One note, this isn't the first time in a tabloid drawn by Ross Andrew and featuring Superman where an important plot element shows up. If I recall correctly, in the first Superman vs. Spider-Man tabloid, Lex Luthor hatches a plot that involves the destruction of human civilization. Dr. Octopus realizes he doesn't like that plot at all and turns against Luthor. In Fortress of Solitude, Roger has similar qualms about Luthor's plan to destroy the Earth. I remember reading that last page on the same day my brothers and I saw Superman 2, that's a great day, and thinking that Roy Thomas had cribbed the same story beat that Jerry Conway had used in Superman vs. Spider-Man. I knew that Thomas was stringing together what felt like entries in the Superman Encyclopedia about the Fortress of Solitude, but then to lift a story element from another tabloid was way more than I expected. Yeah, I don't know, you know, we'll never know whether Roy really did that or not. I mean, the idea of the henchman turning on Lex Luthor is not new. It certainly wasn't anything Jerry came up with. I mean, in Superman the movie, Miss Tessmacher turns on Luthor and helps Superman. So that's a pretty basic comic book story trope. So, you know, Roy may have quote-unquote taken it from Jerry. Jerry probably took it from somebody else. It's all a big mix at this point. So thanks, everybody, for commenting. I really appreciate it. I love getting feedback for these episodes. And so I appreciate all the comments you leave. Next, we're going to move on to Twitter likes and retweets. I really appreciate that. Helps get the show noticed. So thanks to Rolled Spine, Supermates Pod, Kyle Benning Art, Kay Azugio, Dono the Rhino, Comics in the GA, Black Vulcan 69, Mart Gray, Pop Vulc Culture, Longbox Crusade, Static Keeling, Comic Reflection, Bailey's Podcast, Dr. Ann 70, Siskoid, Coffee Comics Blog, M.W. Cronenberg, Luther Lang, Relatively Underscore Geek, Slang Word, Holly Anderson 30, iMusicKey, Skyhook 1, Doc Gamester, Sergey Bamba, Negaziman, RM Ranger, BTO and Bat Books, S. Will Dog, It's Plastic Man, Lore Pseudo, Fletch W. Adams, Afro Programmer, and Not the Real J. Cred. Thank you, everybody. And finally, a couple other comments. Just one on Facebook is left from Alan Wright. He left it on this Fire and Water podcast Facebook page. He says, great show. I love that Superman is a classic film buff, especially of Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland in The Adventures of Robin Hood. Oh, and I think that Churchill/Soviet figure you mentioned is Sidney Greenstreet in The Maltese Falcon. I didn't even think about that, but it could possibly be. And I like it too, that Superman links old movies. That's a charming trait. And then finally, we got an email from David Foster. He sent me some pictures of some treasuries he saw at a used bookstore. And he was like, hey, check out what I found. And they were shots of Shazam, the JLA, Superman versus the Bicentennial, and the famous first edition All-Star Comics tabloids. He doesn't mention in the email whether he bought them or not. I hope he did, because if you ever find treasuries out in the wild, like in a used bookstore, you probably can get it for a good price. So, David, I hope you picked them up, and maybe you will follow through with this comment and let us know if you got them, if you didn't already own them, of course. So that's going to do it for the feedback. Thanks so much to Ryan for coming in to talk about The Astonishing Superman. That's one of my The Astonishing Superman. Did I just say that? The Astonishing Spider-Man. That's one of my all-time favorite treasuries. I was really glad I had a chance to talk about it. Make sure you find Ryan's shows over on our network site, which is, again, of course, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And you can talk about this show and talk about treasuries over on our Twitter feed, which is at Treasury Comics. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Until the next episode, go big or go home.
The world's favorite comic book hero, followed by 84 million readers a year. Now, he comes alive. For the first time on the screen, you'll see it all. The spectacular adventures of the amazing Spider-Man.
He can do the things a spider does, you know, climb walls and spin webs, and he's very, very strong.
You've heard about him. You've read about him. Now, you'll see him in action.
Kill him.
No challenge is too great. No enemy is too strong. The most popular, most daring, most exciting superhero in the entire world. At last, he comes alive for his most incredible adventure. Now, Spider-Man takes on a madman who's turning the streets into a siege of terror. More and more people are being mysteriously hypnotized into threatening the entire city and destroying themselves. Look up high as one man does the impossible. He uses all his fantastic spider powers to battle the most evil forces ever imagined. Live action excitement. The super adventure of everybody's favorite superhero, Spider-Man. Now, he lives.